Hit it. The president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
When we do have secret prisons, that is not what America's all about.
Let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, used to work on the House of Representatives for the Democrats. My guest today is also a former congressional attorney. He used to work for the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee. His name is Terry Campo, and he's currently the head of the Young Republican Alumni, a former chairman of the Young Republican National Federation. So we're going to talk about the issues of the week, and there are a number of issues to talk about. We have the Supreme Court nominee. Who will be the justice that Obama chooses to replace Justice Souter, and what kinds of qualities do we want in a Supreme Court justice? We'll move on to some issues in the District of Columbia. Should D.C. have a right to have its representative in Congress? Should it have the state's rights that states have? Should D.C. voters have a right to choose through their elected representatives their positions, whether on gun control or on issues like marriage? We'll try to have time, hopefully, to talk about the international situation in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and also issues of health care. So there's a lot on the agenda. Terry Campo, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the Supreme Court choice. I want to play for you what President Obama said when he announced what he was looking for in the Supreme Court justice, and get your comment on that.
Now, the process of selecting someone to replace Justice Souter is among my most serious responsibilities as president. So I will seek somebody with a sharp and independent mind and a record of excellence and integrity. I will seek someone who understands that justice isn't about some abstract legal theory or footnote in a casebook. It is also about how our laws affect the daily realities of people's lives, whether they can make a living and care for their families, whether they feel safe in their homes and welcome in their own nation. I view that quality of empathy, of understanding and identifying with people's hopes and struggles as an essential ingredient for arriving at just decisions and outcomes. I will seek somebody who is dedicated to the rule of law, who honors our constitutional traditions, who respects the integrity of the judicial process and the appropriate limits of the judicial role. I will seek somebody who shares my respect for constitutional values on which this nation was founded and who brings a thoughtful understanding of how to apply them in our time. As I make this decision, I intend to consult with members of both parties across the political spectrum, and it is my hope that we can swear in our new Supreme Court justice in time for him or her to be seated by the first Monday in October when the
new court starts. So, Terry, you've heard our president and what he's looking for in the Supreme Court justice. Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good, pretty thoughtful, pretty fair to me. What's your view?
Well, I agree with everything he said, except about the first three or four sentences before he got to the word empathy. I thought the way he describes his empathy, disregarding legal theories, footnotes in some case law, that instead justices need to care about how the laws affect ordinary people. That's not what a Supreme Court justice is supposed to do. Appellate courts are supposed to interpret the law and the case histories and apply the law to the facts at hand. They don't even meet the litigants in a case at the appellate level. So I think the president is supposedly a law professor. He knows that. I think the problem is that when you start defining empathy as caring about the outcomes, as he said, you're talking about looking for judges who have pre-decided a case based upon their feelings toward the litigants and then are going to shape their interpretation of the law to fit that outcome.
Now, I have to say, I'm not surprised that that's the one part of the speech that you didn't like. That is the
one
most Republican commentators point out, even though he talks about respect for the Constitution and the limits on the judicial process, respect for constitutional values, dedication to the rule of law. Now, empathy, you translated as caring about people, but that's, of course, not what empathy is. If you look up empathy in the dictionary, it means understanding. Understanding people's, understanding, as he put it, people's hopes and struggles, and how laws affect people's daily reality. Understanding that, how they make a living, care for their families, safe in their homes. He said that the justice should not be about abstract legal principles. Okay. But on respect for the law and understanding people's value. Now, since empathy is understanding, and maybe some caring, a lot goes along with that understanding. It's very hard to care about someone without understanding. He's not saying that it would overrule the law. He's saying that judges should be informed by the actuality of people's daily lives. Do you think that justices should sit in an ivory tower and not know how people make a living, that that's the kind of justice you want?
Here, if I may, this is what he said in 2001 on a Chicago radio station. It was a panel discussion with two other law professors about the law, and this is what informs my view of how he's, what he really means by that. He said, but the Supreme Court never ventured into the issues of redistribution of wealth and the sort of basic issues of political and economic justice in this society, and to the extent that as radical as people try to characterize the Warren Court, it wasn't that radical. It didn't break free from the essential constraints that were placed by the founding fathers in the Constitution. And he goes on to disparage more that the courts didn't essentially take some of the civil rights cases and use it to redistribute wealth. That, I think, is what he's talking about, and that's what's really of concern
but
here.
But he's not criticizing the Warren Court there. He's
he actually does criticize the Warren Court for not breaking free of the essential constitutional constraints.
That's not at all what he said. You showed me that before the broadcast.
Well, he didn't say it articulately because he didn't have his teleprompter.
He actually said, if you read on to the end of that, at the end, he talks about the fact that that's not the proper role of courts. That, in fact, that's the proper role of people like, the President of the United States and the legislature. Read on to your
actually, he doesn't say that's not the proper role of courts. What he said is it's just the courts aren't very good at it. Although you can craft theoretical justifications for it legally, I think any three of us sitting here could come up with a rationale for bringing about economic change through the courts. I think as a practical matter that our institutions are just poorly equipped to do it.
There you go. He's saying that judges are poorly
equipped to do it.
To do this kind of thing. So here you have a President of the United States saying that economic justice is not properly done through the courts. What the courts are properly doing is civil rights, is making sure that the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution is honored, that everyone gets an equal opportunity under the law. That's what the civil rights movement did. That's what the Warren Court did. And I don't think you have any problem with that.
The 14th Amendment doesn't say equal rights under law. It's civil rights. It's not all rights, and it essentially applies to questions of race. That's the legislative history.
Doesn't say that in the 14th Amendment.
That's the history of the 14th Amendment.
Now, I'm a strict constructionist. I believe in the literal language of the law. You apparently do not believe in strictly abiding by the letter. You believe in, judicial activism, perhaps?
No, I believe in the legislative history as informing what the words mean.
The 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States. It doesn't just refer to slaves. Yes, they are persons.
That was the purpose of the 14th Amendment.
They could have said that. They could have said that.
That was said in the debate over the
15th Amendment. That the right of citizens to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race, color, previous condition of servitude. Right. Clearly the 15th Amendment meant slaves can vote. And that's what the 15th Amendment meant. But the 14th Amendment is much broader than the 15th Amendment. It says all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person, not just people of a certain color or race, any person of liberty or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, you would read this language to only apply to black people?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that doesn't apply to redistribution of the wealth through the courts.
But Obama is saying he doesn't want to do that.
Obama said a lot of things that hasn't been fulfilled by his legislative enactments.
But here's what you did. You read what he said on the radio 8 years ago. And
the term
what he said is that the courts are not particularly good at redistributive justice.
Not particularly good. He didn't say they shouldn't do it. He said they're not particularly good, as in not particularly efficient at it.
In other words, he was explaining to his NPR host why he didn't think that courts should be in the forefront of redistributive justice.
No, he actually wasn't saying why they shouldn't. He was saying why they had not done so far.
Okay. What in his statement Where in his statement do you see that justices need to redistribute wealth?
The statement,
the statement he just made. I could play part of it again.
Okay, no, he doesn't say that in that statement.
Right, so what you're doing is you're attributing to Obama things that he has not said.
Things that he said in the past to explain what he said in, from the teleprompter.
What he said in the past is that courts should not be involved, that they're not the best instruments to be involved.
That's a good way to put it.
And redistributive justice.
That's the good way to put it. He said they weren't the best instruments.
And you know what? I agree with him.
I agree with that too.
The president and the Congress, they're the ones that should look out for the general welfare.
And
that's what's in our Constitution.
And actually, that's exactly it, is that he's essentially looking, though, for the courts to assume a role that this should be fulfilled by the legislature. Empathy, understanding how things affect real people.
Okay.
Those are things that the legislature should do. That's what majorities of the legislature
Justices should not understand how the law affects real people. You think they should simply not understand and forget that real people exist and apply the law blindly as if it doesn't affect real lives.
Appellate courts, as opposed to trial court, should interpret the law.
Right. And they should do so without any regard to how it affects real people.
If the law is completely unworkable,
they should do it, even though we know
that it's
not
working. They remand the cases back to the trial courts to conduct further proceedings in light of their interpretation of the law. They don't do that themselves.
But I want to understand your argument here. You're saying that it is better to have a justice mm-hmm. on the Supreme Court who does not understand the ordinary lives of people, who
now,
does not understand their daily
words.
Reality.
I'm not saying doesn't understand. I'm not saying that that isn't their job, it isn't their authority, and it's a violation of their oath. They're supposed to interpret and apply the law.
Now, Terry, you know that courts all the time take laws, mm-hmm. and they say, you know what, this isn't working. This principle isn't working. This balancing test that we developed 20, 30 years ago isn't working. It isn't deciding real life cases. Mm-hmm. We need to rework this test to make sure that something that maybe there's a bright line, easily applied. Some of the religious, for example, decisions, mm-hmm. You may know the Lemon v. Kurtzman test, that most of our listeners don't know what that is, but basically it's a decision of when the government can or can't intervene in religion and fund religion. And they said, you know what, this test isn't working. It isn't giving us a bright line test mm-hmm. that affects the realities. We should do something that's more practical. You don't think the judges should do that?
No, that's the judges essentially interpreting the manner in which they have previously attempted to interpret what the law is and set examples. That's a totally
but
different thing than rewriting
the law.
Laws.
They're looking at the effects of the law
and they're,
on ordinary
and they're
people.
Admitting that they're not very good at doing exactly that. That's why they have to remand these things back to the trial court.
So you would pick a justice then that has had maybe no practical legal experience, someone
not.
Who's only a professor
that's just
in some
a total
ivory
red
tower.
Herring.
Well, I'm just trying to understand find so offensive about what he said. Let me replay again.
Okay,
I want to find what you find that's so offensive about it, because it seems very mm-hmm. normal to me. I'll play it again.
Abilities as president. So I will seek somebody with a sharp and independent mind and a record of excellence and integrity. I will seek someone who understands that justice isn't about some abstract legal theory or footnote in a case book. It is also about how our laws affect the daily realities of people's lives, whether they can make a living and care for their families, whether they feel safe in their homes and welcome in their own nation. I view that quality of empathy, of understanding and identifying with people's hopes and struggles as an essential ingredient for arriving at just decisions and outcomes.
Okay.
If I may, that's that last line there, that particularly, the fact that really the last word is what I found really disturbing.
I'm going to give you a full chance to explain all your problems with it, but we have to take a break.
Sorry.
I also want to invite our listeners to call in and get your interpretation of what we need, what kind of justice we want on the Supreme Court. Do you agree with President Obama? Do you agree with me? Do you agree with Terry? Do you disagree with all of us? 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
Wash your car at home.
I wash my car. Everything runs down the street and down into the storm drains. With all the chemicals in the soaps and waxes, the last thing I want to do is poison my own drinking water.
At least here, it's all contained and recycled on site.
That's why I also take my car in for oil changes instead of doing it myself. I might take a chance on spilling stuff.
You know what the best part is?
What?
More time to kick back and watch the game.
How far would you go to protect the planet?
I want you to build an ark.
Maybe there's another way.
People, the flood is imminent.
Is it too much to ask for a little precipitation?
Go to fightglobalwarming.com to find out what you and your community can do to reduce global warming pollution.
Somewhere around the world, there are men and women of the armed forces risking their lives, helping rebuild communities after natural disasters, collecting toys for needy children, tutoring kids in school. These are your sons and daughters who work to keep us safe, secure, and free. Dedicated men and women who put their country first.
Here again, the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Justice Souter has retired. President Obama will very soon nominate someone to take his place. What kind of qualities should a Supreme Court justice have? I'm debating that point with my guest. His name is Terry Campo. He is the president of the Young Republicans Alumni Association. He used to help the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee. I used to help the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee. And when two congressional lawyers go at it, you know there'll be a little bit of fireworks. But I want to give you your say.
That's right.
But right before the break, I played President Obama, the part of what he said troubled you the most, mm-hmm. the part about a justice having empathy for ordinary people and understanding how laws mm-hmm. change their lives.
Right.
You have a severe problem with that.
Well, it was just I don't have a problem with the word empathy, but the problem was what he said before empathy, that he defined empathy essentially as those things. And then what he bottom lined it, and this was the takeaway that that does trouble me, he says that these are essential ingredients to arriving at just decisions and outcomes. The justices on the United States Supreme Court should not be deciding what the outcomes they desire are and then working based on their empathy or whether they think that people can earn a living or feel welcome in their country. Those are decisions for the legislature to make. Those are what policy is supposed to be. When he starts dictating that is the outcomes and that everything flows from that, I find that very troubling.
Now, of course, President Obama mm-hmm. gave a longer
right.
list
yes.
of things that he wanted. Sharp and independent mind,
right.
respect for constitutional values that date back to our
right.
nation's founding. He gave a laundry list of
right.
things, and he said one of those things, not mm-hmm. the only thing, is not to dictate the outcomes and work backwards, which is what mm-hmm. you just said, but simply to understand how the role that the law plays in people's lives,
mm-hmm.
how it actually affects their lives. In other words, what I think he's saying is we don't want a pure ivory tower professor who has never had a middle class upbringing or knows anybody with a middle class upbringing who doesn't understand how laws affect real people and is simply saying, well, we'll do this abstract legal principle. Is he wrong?
First of all, Scalia, Alito have middle-class upbringings. They were from working-class families. Breyer, Ginsburg do not. The idea that these people who have been on the courts of appeals, have been university law professors, don't have any understanding of real life is a red herring.
No, you can be very rich and understand real people's lives. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a famously patrician president, and yet he was a working class hero for what he did in the
museum. I don't think he understood working class people's lives.
Well, I think working class people were very thankful
that they got money.
So I'm not saying that he has to avoid a rich person or hire a middle class.
Right.
I'm not saying
right.
that. But the idea that a justice should understand how ordinary people live, to me, seems basic. Not
There's
even
nothing wrong with understanding how they live. The problem is taking that type of approach to interpreting the law, the Constitution, the legislative history behind the statutes, the debates from the Madison's notes, the debates of the Federal Convention, all of those things that illustrate what was intended by the words of that document.
As we were just talking about the 14th Amendment.
I have no problem with looking at that. Like I said, I am a liberal, strict constructionist, and I always have been. I was called the textualist.
Well, you know, I was going to say, actually, in fact, the Lilly Ledbetter case is one of the examples, whether or not we agree with the outcome or whatever. It's a perfect example of how things should work. The Supreme Court reached its decision based upon its interpretation of the law, essentially, that effectively a statute of limitations existed and she filed her claim too late. The Congress did not like that response and made a big issue of, and President Obama made it an issue of the campaign, and I believe it was the first act of Congress.
One of the very first.
Very first, but as soon as they got into office with Democratic majorities and Democratic president, they passed a law changing the Equal Pay Act to overturn, in effect, the court's interpretation. That's the way it should work.
And of course, when you have a statute, that's exactly what the court does, and that's exactly what Congress can do. When you're talking about constitutional interpretation, you need a constitutional amendment to overturn the court, which is a huge difference. But on the Lilly Ledbetter case, I think that's a classic example of how a court gets something wrong. Here you have a statute that was designed to help women who'd been discriminated against, designed specifically, Equal Pay Act, to help when women are being paid less than men. And the court came up with, I think, a really cockamamie idea. The idea that a woman who'd been discriminated against for two decades, all right, that every single time she got a paycheck, that was a new act of discrimination, and so she could sue only for what she just discovered for the last 6 months and not for the past 20 years.
Maybe it was 12 years.
In other words, what the Supreme Court said with your favorite justices, Alito and Scalia and the majority, is that if you can commit fraud and trick a woman into thinking she's getting equal pay when actually you're cheating her and paying the men more and not letting her know that she's being mistreated. In other words, if you can break the law and get away with it, we're okay with that. But equality only counts if you catch us in the act of discrimination. That, to me, is exactly not having the empathy to understand real people's lives that President Obama's talking about.
First of all, I don't think it constitutes fraud. I think that's a loaded term. I don't think it constitutes fraud. But
it's not fraud to pay your employee. They told her she was getting paid the same as the men.
12 years she waited to bring the case.
She didn't know she was being mistreated.
No, it was 12 years after she had found now, but she waited until...
No. That's not true. Well, the facts of Lilly Ledbetter are that she was lied to, she was told she was paid equal, and she only discovered the 12 years
she
of discrimination.
She should have brought a civil action for fraud, not a violation of the Equal Pay Act, if that's the case.
You know, you can again, that's an example of technicalities and abstract legal principles.
It's the
purpose of the law was to protect her rights.
The law being used as written by the Congress.
Well, again, I think if the justices had some idea of both where that law came from, what its goals were.
I believe it came from the Congress.
Well, it did come from the Congress. And their goal was to equalize the pay, namely the name Equal Pay Act, between men and women. Clearly, the Congress that passed that law originally didn't intend that a woman who'd been discriminated against for 12 years could only sue for the past 6 months.
They didn't address it?
Well, you know, maybe sometimes it's important to look and see the legislative intent. I believe
in that.
The legislative intent of the Equal Pay Act was, call me crazy, equal pay.
Well, actually, usually when Congress comes up with a nice sounding name like that, that's the last thing they intend.
Well, sometimes they do.
Sort of like the Environmental Protection Act.
But I think that's exactly President Obama's point. I want to read from some of our comments from our listeners. Terry, a different Terry, not you, writes, I don't think that all Republicans hate empathy. But a majority of the party do seem to have a feeling of and tend to look out for number one, whether it's regarding social programs, healthcare, or business policy. What those who hate empathy don't understand is the best way to solve your own problem is to help someone else solve his. Is that a fair criticism of the Republican Party?
Well, I don't, you know, other than take out the criticism of the Republican Party, I don't disagree that you should help other people when you can. I'm trying to look here regarding social programs, healthcare. I'm sorry, I don't really think that's a very informed comment.
You don't.
Honesty.
I mean, you don't think that Republicans are very much the party of individualism and not the party of helping others?
I think being an individual and looking out for yourself to make sure you provide for your family and is the best way to ensure that you can help other people.
The fact that they
use the term hate empathy.
Well, that was my term, to be
clear. No, hate empathy is in their text.
No, I know it is. That's to be fair, Terry is responding to...
I'm the one who caused the
problem to begin with. I'm not going to blame Terry
for that. We have an editor that's shaping things.
Fair enough. But my question is, do you think that Republicans believe in a policy, much like John F. Kennedy once said, ask not what your country can do
actually,
for you,
Republicans but what you can do and conservatives tend to be the more generous people, much more generous than liberals. Republicans give away their own money to help poor people, as I often
do. With commissions and strings attached. You have to pray to my God to get my money,
that. I've never done that.
Should the government help those less fortunate? In America, should people die because they're too poor to afford health care,
The problem with government is it usually doesn't do a very good job of helping anybody. And what its programs tend to do is be programs that employ middle-class people who can feel good about having done something today that propended to help people. Frankly, more people are helped by churches than by government. Poor people have received more from a higher and standard of living because of Walmart's low prices than the $1 trillion we've spent on anti-poverty programs.
So you think most Americans would be willing to give up Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid?
Oh, I think that most Americans are not.
Just rely on the goodness of churches, and if churches want to help them, they live, and if churches don't want to help them, I guess they die.
You just flipped the question there. You asked me which is more effective. Now you're switching which more Americans would support. Americans like to get their money. Like to get their checks.
I'm not saying either or, Terry. Mm-hmm. I'm saying
both.
I'm saying both and. For example, let's look at President Obama's health care proposal.
Okay.
What
is his proposal, by the way?
I'll tell you his proposal. His proposal is not to have the government take over all health care. If that's what you think it is, don't worry. That's not his proposal. I know it's being portrayed that way. President Obama's proposal is this: to allow government to take a segment of health care for anyone who voluntarily signs up for it. You have the government competing with private business. Capitalism made the best system win. If people want to sign up for the government plan, they can. If they want to sign up for private insurance, they can.
Remember the Ashwander case?
What is wrong with having the government help and private industry help and let the people choose?
Because when the government creates a parallel system, it does it with taxpayer money that subsidizes unfair competition against the private sector. Just like in the Ashwander case. That's why I was asking if you remember the Ashwander case, where literally, because the federal government got into the power business at the TVA to underwrite the defense plants, they were then able to impose extra costs and fix the prices of their private sector competitors. Or for that matter, the Postal Service and Federal Express. You know, the Post Office used to have this ad that would always say, and usually only at half the price of Federal Express. You know why? Because there's a provision in the Postal Service Act that prohibits anyone from providing the same service at less than double the price what the Post Office has.
And yet, Terry, your example shows perfectly what's the problem with competition. We have the Post Office. We have Federal Express. They both exist. People continue to use the Post Office. People continue to use Federal Express. Let 1,000 flowers bloom. Isn't that what capitalism is
all about? Well, actually, the Post Office is going to be the model for government medical care.
You know, it seems to me that your real goal is to protect pharmaceutical companies. I know that Republicans fought very, very hard against allowing the government to negotiate better prices, as they do in Canada, as they do in England and France.
Well, first of all,
want to make sure that people pay a ton for those drugs because those pharmaceutical companies help Republicans in their campaign.
I, first of all, have never gotten a dime from the pharmaceutical industry. I'm not trying
to protect.
I'm not trying to protect. But I will tell you this, though. The pharmaceutical industry. Okay.
Can we come back
and talk about the pharmaceutical industry?
I'll be happy to, and also to take your call. Join in the debate. This is your show as well. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
Saving for retirement might be easy for some folk, but for others, it might take a little more work. And for those who haven't started, there are still things you can do to catch up.
Oh, that is good news.
Like getting out from underneath past debt. And don't get wrapped up with high-interest credit cards.
Get you some eyes.
Be diversified with your investments. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Your financial goals are not out of reach. The choice is clear. For a happy ending, choose to save.
Everyone with alcohol and drug addiction is in the same boat. With treatment, you can find solid ground. For drug and alcohol information and treatment referral for you or someone you know, call 1-800-662-HELP.
Dude, are you sure you want this tattoo? Because
just do it.
Some mistakes in life
are permanent, like hearing loss. To learn how to protect your hearing, visit ASHA.org.
You've probably heard about heart disease, but did you know that it's the number one killer of women nationwide? Heart disease claims more lives each year than breast cancer, lung cancer, or strokes combined, but there are steps you can take to protect yourself against it. For more information on how you can prevent heart disease, contact your local American Heart Association or visit their website at www.americanheart.org.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm debating the issues of the week with Terry Campo. He is the president of the Young Republican Alumni and a former congressional attorney for the Republicans. I'm a former congressional attorney for the Democrats, and so we're bringing it on. And you can bring it on, too. Please join us. You can agree with me or Terry or disagree with both of us. That's your free right at 888-488-MARK. 888-488-6275. Terry, you were telling us why you oppose the Obama health care plan.
Well, first of all, I don't think that we have an Obama health care plan yet. That's, I think, the point I was going to try and correct, but it's to the pharmaceutical issue that I'd like to, that we went out on. There's something that I think needs to be put on the table here, and that is that in this country, and you know this as a Senate or as a House Judiciary Committee lawyer, that in this country, a long time ago, there was a policy decision made to allow the pharmaceutical industry to be able to recover the cost of research and development, patenting of new drugs through the patent process. That was essentially, they essentially got a captured market for seven and then renewed usually for the additional 7 years. This, as a result of that, this country has innovation in patented medicine and pharmaceuticals. Canada and almost every other country, the European countries that have state-run medical systems that, as you call it, negotiate but essentially fixes the price, they take our innovation that we are paying for as American patients, I guess you could say, for free. We're paying the cost of developing the drugs for the world because of that patent policy.
Let me give you another source of American innovation, and it's something that our newest Democratic Senator Arlen Specter is a big fan of, the NIH, the National Institute of Health. We provide, probably more than most countries, maybe more than any other country, a large amount of government money, taxpayer money, to do basic medical research, so the pharmaceuticals profit from what the government has done. Also, you, as I'm sure you well know, pharmaceuticals spend far more money on advertising than they do on research. That's why you at home see all those commercials for, sexual things, and for maybe, have you ever been sad? Look at this drug, ask your pharmacist, and watch out for all these side effects. The reason why they focus on the designer drugs rather than on such basic cures for cancer and the things that really do kill people is because, well, that's something they've already made. They tweak a molecule or so and they get those patents that you're talking about. Given that we the people, we the taxpayers, we the government, and I do think we are the government, help pharmaceutical companies in this way, what's wrong with negotiating to get better prices like they do in virtually every other country on
Earth? Well, you're talking about basically just between applications research and basic research, and this is done in all on all sorts of sectors, not just in pharmaceuticals. It's done through the national labs at University of Chicago and various at University of California, Berkeley, these in the energy field. So whether or not that's good policy, that's been essentially what's been going on for 50 years in this country, is the government funds through funds basic research.
I think that's very good policy.
Maybe,
I think it helps
maybe
the pharmaceutical companies, and I think that they, like any good American citizens, but owe something to their country.
But the government isn't negotiating when it comes in and says that we are going to pay the following price.
It's
That's not a negotiation. That's not a negotiation.
Look,
that's a negotiation like Hank Paulson sitting at the Bank of America and say, we're going to take a third of your bank.
And the reason it's not is because government doesn't control all of health care. As you well know, government
that's
controls
the way they
Medicaid,
get into it.
It controls Medicare, it can set the
and
prices.
And that's actually what's driven up the prices, the government's intervention in the Medicaid
system.
Well,
you can't have it both ways, Terry.
No,
you're telling me that
the
government shouldn't be allowed to lower prices, and now you're telling me the government's pushing up prices.
Did not say the government shouldn't be allowed to lower the prices. I'm saying that the Medicaid system is what has created the inefficiencies in the healthcare delivery system that is then transferred by the medical care providers onto the private insurance costs.
Terry, I think you are saying the government should be allowed to lower prices. I know that your party, and I was there in the House when this happened.
I don't think the government should be setting prices.
We had a vote. And the vote was on the Medicare prescription drug bill proposed by President Bush. And you don't have to agree with it, but I can tell you this. One of the amendments that we Democrats tried to add to that bill was an amendment to allow the government to negotiate, not set, to negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical companies.
And
your party was against it. So, and I don't know, your view obviously is that that's wrong.
I think, yeah, I'm opposed to the government having a role in setting the prices of the medicine.
Right, and I assume you're also opposed to unions having a role in saying the prices of labor workers?
No, that's a totally different matter. That's private parties negotiating.
It seems to me that whenever you have a large institution and a bunch of small groups, whether it's one employer and lots of workers or one pharmaceutical company and lots of individuals, the large institution has far more power than individuals. You cannot negotiate over a cancer drug that's going to save your life.
Again, we have
need to buy it, whether it costs $1,000 or $10,000. Well, what the government does, let me suggest to you, and I'll let you respond. What the government does, what I would like to see the government do in pharmaceuticals, is exactly what unions do for workers. Put all Americans together and have a power equivalent to the power of the pharmaceutical company. Now, the pharmaceutical company can reject that. They can negotiate it. They can sell outside the government. So it's not a complete power. It's a lot like unions. It's collective bargaining.
Well,
what's wrong with it?
Well, first of all, there's a total difference in the healthcare field because essentially the government intervention is what's driven in these up these costs. This is the government interference in the delivery of healthcare. The fact that we have, really, when you get right down to it, almost five different decision makers in the purchase of healthcare in this country. That's what has really messed things up.
I agree. It's too much. It's too expensive. The insurance companies add all these middlemen, and the government won't require that. And here's the deal. If you want to continue
on your private
insurance...
And the government actually prohibits the insurance companies from even developing a common form that the doctor's office can use.
Yeah, monopoly. Sherman Antitrust Act. You're probably opposed to that as well.
No, I'm thinking that that's a silly prohibition, though, to have as common standardizing the form.
We should give pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies more power to control people's lives.
I'm not asking for them to be able to control people's life. I'm asking for people to be able to control their own
lives. No, you're saying that your company
medical savings accounts would have been a far more effective way.
You're changing the subject here.
You're changing the subject.
No, what you're saying is, you said the insurance company should be able to agree on a common form. So they can say, you want this cancer-saving drug, we're going to charge you $1,000.
I didn't say common price. I said common form. The form that is used in the doctor's office should be standardized.
By the way, the
government is effectively a co-conspirator in setting the price with the patent policy.
Well, I have no problem with a common form. In fact,
the government's setting the price through the patent policy.
Patents have a long story tradition, as you know. But President Obama has, in fact, in computerizing a lot of medical healthcare, is helping to do common forms.
Presumably that will help.
So I'm glad to know that you agree with President Obama.
I think that standardizing the medical records and putting them electronically is a good idea.
What do you know? You and I and the president all agree on something.
I don't think the president's wrong on everything.
I'm glad to hear that.
No.
I'm glad to hear that. Let me ask you about something that's away from national policy but affects national policy. And it's the question of states' rights. Now, Republicans tend to love states' rights. They love the 10th Amendment. And the question is whether states' rights should apply to only the American citizens who live in the 50 states, or should also apply to the American citizens that live in the District of Columbia, very, very, very close by. Now, the District of Columbia wants the right to have a vote in Congress. The people of the District of Columbia want to have the same rights that everyone from the populous state of California to the state of Wyoming, which has fewer people than those in the district, has. Right now, in fact, they're not even asking for two senators, just simply a seat in the House. That's democratic. Do you oppose that?
Well, first of all, the District of Columbia is not a state. It is a federal enclave that was created, I think, was it 1791, I think? To be the seat of the national capital at that time.
But there's nothing in here about you have to disenfranchise the people who live in
it. No, but it does require that the representatives in Congress and the senators be representatives of states, which the District of Columbia is not. Would be in Article 1, Section 2, I believe.
But it also says in Article 1, Section 8, that Congress shall have the right to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over that district.
Right.
So it seems to me that...
Isn't that what the District of Columbia... That's right.
That Congress can say, all right, we're going to allow you, the district, to have a representative.
I think that means that the Congress has the right to decide what the laws of for the taxi meters are, even though it's a stupid thing for having Congress to do.
I agree to stupid thing for having Congress to do.
It's not a matter of having Congress decide to give the District of Columbia a vote in Congress. Now, you know what D.C. should do? D.C. should
become a state.
D.C. should go back into Maryland and have its representative in Congress that way.
Why can't D.C. become a state?
Well, it could if you want to amend the Constitution.
You don't
but
need
last
to.
Time it, I disagree. And
the
last
to make D.C. a
Jimmy,
state?
Jimmy
Why?
Carter.
Why do you have
Jimmy,
to amend the Constitution?
You have to amend
Congress
the
can admit any state to the union.
No, excuse me. To amend, give them representation, I should say, without being become a state, you have to amend the Constitution.
Right, but
as
they can
Jimmy
become
Carter,
a state, and you don't have to amend the Constitution.
No, they could be admitted as a state.
I agree.
I don't think it should be, because I think it should be a federal enclave. I do think, though, that Virginia got its portion of D.C. back before the Civil War. Maryland should get its part back, and that way D.C. citizens could be represented as part of the state
and,
of Maryland.
And that way the White House and the Congress can be ruled under Maryland law. That's what you
well,
want.
Well, that if you want to, I think that you would have, again, the federal property, as the Park Service does, actually be the legal authority of all the federal buildings.
Let me ask you this. You agree that in general, mm-hmm. the people of D.C., like the people of any state mm-hmm. in the United States, should have autonomy, local autonomy.
They should have the right to
control their own lives, decide their own legislation.
I think, for most part, their legislation should be basically under the home rule powers that they were given should essentially be that.
And yet the Senate of the United States, mm-hmm. with every single Republican voting and a few Democrats mm-hmm. as well, has said, we want to impose our gun laws on the District of Columbia. You had Montana saying, you know, in Montana we hunt and there's lots of open space. We like to have as many guns as possible, so we're going to force the District of Columbia
isn't a state.
Think it's fair for the people of Nevada and Montana to determine the rights of the people of the District of Columbia?
The clause you just read there about exercising exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia, that's exactly
just
the power
Congress
in which that proceeds
has
under.
Has the right to do it. Doesn't mean they should
they
do
have
it.
The authority to do
I
it.
I agree they have the authority to do it.
All right, good.
Is it, however, right? You Republicans often complain when the federal government exercises authority over things that you say. Let me finish.
Is
then
a
respond.
Sovereign
let
power respond. That created the
let
national
let me respond.
Government.
Let me respond. Republicans often complain mm-hmm. when the federal government exercises its authority mm-hmm. over issues that you think should be controlled by the local mm-hmm. populace. Are you indeed saying that I agree Congress has the authority, mm-hmm. that you think Congress should exercise its authority and overturn the will of the duly elected Democratic representatives of the District of Columbia so as to force this local group to do what the federal government wants them to do?
I am from Chicago. The city of Chicago, as much as it thinks it's bigger than the state of Illinois, has the same relationship to the state of Illinois that Washington, D.C. has to the United States Congress. It was created and chartered by them. It has the powers
really,
that they have.
Really, because I thought Chicago had representatives in the Illinois legislature.
It does.
Well, but D.C. has no representatives in Congress.
Well, that's a matter of the Constitution.
All right,
the fact that it was
so
a federal
you and I will support changing the Constitution to give D.C. equal rights under the law. Let me suggest to you.
No, that's
let
not
me
well, equal rights under the law. What are we talking about here? Representation in Congress?
Let me
have
suggest
that as
to you
part of Maryland.
That the 14th Amendment
mm-hmm.
amends the Constitution of the United States.
Oh, see, that's,
gives
that's
everyone
the problem
equal
with liberals' interpretation
under
of the 14th Amendment.
I don't believe.
Liberals stretch every word of the Constitution, particularly from the 14th Amendment, to give them the power to change everything.
I don't believe that D.C. citizens mm-hmm. should have fewer rights than any other American citizen. You would make D.C. citizens second-class citizens. That's what you support,
Not
right?
saying that. I'm saying that the Constitution does that.
And
Constitution
I'm
makes
arguing,
it a federal enclave.
Oh, I'm arguing that the 14th Amendment changed it, and if it didn't, it should be changed. So we agree that
if
it should
be changed.
If you
want to propose a constitutional
amendment,
there was
one, and it didn't pass.
It
didn't
exactly.
Right. So the better.
And so you want to achieve it
response,
now that the country rejected it?
Well, no. Actually, the 14th Amendment is part of our Constitution.
Actually, the 14th Amendment was rescinded by three of those states that ratified it after following the ratification.
But without the 14th Amendment, mm-hmm. all right, all we have to do to be perfectly fair to D.C. is to admit it from its territorial status.
This is the problem with the liberals' approach to the Constitution.
To any, just like any other state.
You guys want to take any words
Wyoming
and twist it into something
people,
that was never meant to be.
Wyoming has fewer people than D.C.
And
two
D.C.
senators
and Wyoming
and a representative. Let me finish what I'm saying. Wyoming has fewer people than
Wyoming
D.C.
Wyoming is a state.
It has
admitted
two
to the
senators.
Union.
Right.
By the Congress.
So here's my solution. Admit the District of Columbia as a state into the United States. You agree they have the authority to do that,
I
right?
believe they have the authority to do
Terrific.
That.
Terrific.
I don't think it should be, but I believe they have the authority
and
to do
And you don't
that.
Think it should be because you don't think the District of Columbia, people there should have the same rights as Wyoming, and you know why? Because they're mostly Democrats.
No, because if I want them to become,
oppose
no,
it.
They should become part of Maryland, and they would have all those same rights because they, actually, District of Columbia doesn't have enough people to even contain a full congressional district, but let them become part of Maryland.
District of Columbia has more, as we discussed,
than
Wyoming. The entire state of
Wyoming. Those are totally different questions.
And you know what? The District of Columbia has been separate from Maryland for 200 plus years. It's time to give them state of their own. We'll be right back. If you want to comment, 888-488-MARK, right back.
Very good at switching the argument.
turn my child's public school into a whole new kind of school. One with a curriculum that really motivates kids. One that has extended hours, 6 days a week, year-round. With loads of academic, cultural, and recreational activities. One that has support services, like medical and dental, right there. A school where parents' involvement is encouraged. Where teachers have more time to teach. And students are excited about learning. There's just one problem. My child doesn't ever want to come home. You can help turn your school into a community school for excellence. Find out how. Call 1-877-LOVE-TO-LEARN.
It's coming. Right to your neighborhood. And when it does, you may be surprised. It's your Social Security statement of your benefits, and it's going to help you plan your financial future. Your benefit statement will tell you how much Social Security you're eligible to receive and when you'll get it. Then you'll know how much you need to save for retirement, because that's coming too. The future is in your hands. Choose to save.
The toxic fumes from this meth lab are seeping into Jamie's sinus cavity. Ammonia vapors invade her throat. Toxic gases fill her lungs. Jamie's body is deteriorating. And she doesn't even know it.
Jamie, dinner.
So, who has the drug problem now? Find out how meth affects you at drugfree.org/meth.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. This is the last segment. There is still time for you to call in and have your voice heard. Some of you have been writing on the blog. That's fine. But if you really want to make sure your comment gets on the air, call in. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. My guest is Terry Campo. He is the president of the Young Republican Alumni Association. And we're talking about all kinds of things that are in the news. I want to switch to foreign policy because this is something I think both Democrats and Republicans are equally nervous about, and that's the situation in Pakistan.
Yeah.
You have, and in Afghanistan as well, yeah. It seems like the Taliban is gaining strength. It seems like Al-Qaeda is gaining strength. And let me suggest to you that one of the reasons for that is because for the last 7 or 8 years, we've been focusing all of our attention, not all of our attention, but the great majority of our attention and our money and our resources and our men and women in arms on Iraq, and letting Afghanistan fall by the wayside. It seems to me that the newly elected government of Pakistan, replacing the dictator Musharraf, needs our help and deserves our help far more than the dictator Musharraf ever did. I think President Obama is doing the right thing in this regard. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think that I want to agree with the first part of what you've said, that we have to both be concerned. And because of that concern, it's such a precipitous situation there. Even if I didn't agree with the details of President Obama's policies, I would generally support those policies because it's that important. I would disagree with your premise that the problems in Iraq, or excuse me, in Afghanistan and Pakistan are the result of the war in Iraq. I think in reality, if it weren't for the war in Iraq, we wouldn't be paying any attention at all to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and we need to be paying attention to them.
Whoa.
I
want you to try to back this up.
Okay.
The Al-Qaeda attacked us on September 11, 2001, was sheltered by the Taliban in Afghanistan,
right.
Murdered 3,000 innocent Americans. We went to war in Afghanistan, and as you recall, every single one save one of the 535 members of Congress supported that war. Mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans mm-hmm. came together. This is a war that 98% of Americans supported. Iraq was not at all that kind
but
of a war.
But that's not the reason why we're not. That's not the reason for the problem in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
But
Iraq
you just
is not
said that
reason.
Iraq that helped somehow.
No, that's not what I said.
Okay.
You've been watching Chris Matthews too much and watching the way he does the syllogisms. I was saying that if it wasn't for the fact that we were at war in Iraq, we wouldn't be paying attention to what's going on in Afghanistan.
We'd be paying attention because they
attacked
us.
We need to be. No, we would have long ago walked away and dropped the ball, as Americans unfortunately tend to do when we think a problem is solved. Afghanistan
Pakistan
are going to take a long-term commitment.
Because
from the United States.
Of the war in Iraq, we're paying attention to Afghanistan?
Yeah.
I'm not following your logic there.
Because we have troops in theater that we wouldn't have troops in otherwise. The situation, particularly in Pakistan, is a very precarious situation. And we would have allowed that to go the same way we allowed Afghanistan to go to the Taliban after the Russians pulled out, if it weren't for the fact that we are now engaged in the theater.
Well, I frankly, I don't see the logic there. It seems to me that we went to war in Afghanistan because of the attack on September 11th. Mm-hmm. And what happened during that time, of course, is you had Iraq have up to 150,000 troops in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Afghanistan, during the Bush administration, was something like 15, 20,000.
Which was about 30.
In any case, you had at least five times mm-hmm. the number of troops in Iraq. In a country that, let's face it, most people don't even recognize this, Iraq is smaller than Afghanistan. Afghanistan is about 50% larger and has a larger population as well. And yet we're putting between a tenth and a fifth the size, 10 to 20% of what we're doing in Iraq. We didn't have enough men in arms, save a draft, put the people in Afghanistan that needed to be there to make it a safe place and to beat the Taliban.
Then why isn't President Obama, now that we're taking the troops out of Iraq, putting more into Afghanistan?
He is.
They fired the general today who was saying he needed more troops.
He's putting more troops in Afghanistan.
He's putting 11,000.
Right now. And he's putting more in.
But those are troops that are being now withdrawn from Iraq because the situation there is so much more improved.
What he's saying is that...
I'm not disagreeing with the president's policies, by the way.
The president is saying exactly what I've been saying, and I think even what you've been saying. Afghanistan and Pakistan are far more important to American security than Iraq.
It's not what I was saying. I was saying that
we
would.
Do you disagree with that?
First of all, I think what Pakistan is far more important right now because of.
I agree that they have nuclear weapons. Absolutely.
But Iraq was a long-term problem, a boil that had to be lanced. We had bad intelligence, but so did everybody else in the world. Now the bottom line.
A long-term boil that had to be lanced. Isn't that true of Darfur? Isn't that true of Venezuela?
No.
Isn't that true of? No, Darfur, there's genocide going on. I mean, why, apart from oil?
Okay, now we're going to switch to Darfur from...
You said that Iraq was a
really good
oil that
liberals
had to be
are left. Really good at deciding that American foreign policy interests are anywhere other than where our interests are.
That's the interesting thing. Mm-hmm. You think our interests were in Iraq. I've argued that we agree, in fact, mm-hmm. that Pakistan and Afghanistan
have
larger American interests than Iraq ever did.
Afghanistan actually is less of a matter of American national security
they
than Pakistan.
They attacked us.
That was because
I'm sure
of the
you believe in self-defense.
I believe that we had to remove the Taliban. And
right.
I think we have to make a long-term commitment to building a country there, not rebuilding, because there never really was a country there.
I agree. And it was, of course, the first President Bush that removed a lot of our influence in Afghanistan.
The real problem is we're basically being the cleanup man for British imperialism. British created
on
the
that,
mess.
I agree with you. But here's Obama's point.
Mm-hmm.
Because he agrees, along with you mm-hmm. and me, that Pakistan and Afghanistan are far more mm-hmm. important than Iraq. He's focusing on that rather than Iraq.
I didn't say it was more important than Iraq.
You don't think so?
I think it's a very important
to American
situation.
Interests?
I think Iraq is important to American interests, and I think Pakistan is very
what
important to American
What importance does Iraq have to American interests that required us to go in the first
Iraq
place?
Iraq is one of the most strategically important countries in the Middle East. It is.
Well, so is Iran. Maybe we should invade there.
Iran is an extremely important country in the Middle East.
Saudi Arabia has a lot of oil. Let's invade
Saudi Arabia is not an enemy of the United States.
Well, they provided 15 of the 19 hijackers.
No, they didn't provide it. They're citizens, just like if you were to go out and strap some dynamite onto your chest and blow up some people in Tel Aviv. That would be like saying the Americans are behind.
But there is some evidence that the Saudi government was aware. We don't have to get into that right now. But my general point is this.
Mm-hmm.
There are many dictators all across the globe.
Yeah.
Liberia, Venezuela.
And we have to budget.
Right.
We have to budget.
We have to choose accordingly.
Pakistan is an extremely important situation.
I agree with you on the importance of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. I agree with you on the importance of Afghanistan because I believe firmly in the right of self-defense. But compared to Pakistan and Afghanistan, let me suggest to you that Iraq under Saddam Hussein was way down the list. Saddam Hussein was a man that certainly Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney felt they could deal with, and they did deal with him. They gave him all kinds of arms.
That was
in
the 1970s when they were
80s.
At war with Iran as
right.
part of a dual containment
right. so,
policy.
So, wouldn't you agree that Darfur going on mm-hmm. in Sudan mm-hmm. is far more important than Iraq for American.
Well, Darfur is a terrible situation, but we don't have the access to it. We don't have the ability.
Do we have the access to Iraq?
Yeah, we do.
We did before we invaded.
We certainly did. We had the bases in Saudi Arabia. We have the bases in Turkey. We had the access to do something there, and we had our national interest.
So you don't think we can do anything about Darfur in terms of?
I didn't say we can't do anything, but the bottom line is that it's going to take a more of an effort to do something right in Darfur than I think we have the patience for.
Let me suggest to you that one of the reasons why the world was so unhappy with the United States of America under George Bush, and why they're actually fairly happy with the United States under Barack Obama, is that they see that Barack Obama is trying to make America a force for good in the world, not just to take oil, not just for strategic places, not just, Iraq is sitting on a really important area, we're going to take it, but actually to help people. Now, I would like to see Barack Obama do more in Darfur. I'll say that.
Why don't the Western Europeans do more in Darfur?
Because I think they are not concerned about the moral implications either.
But they're the ones who were concerned about judging. You were just talking about how the world likes us so much better because of Obama.
I think there's two different things. Standing by while evil occurs is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've done
Kind of like the Dutch watching the Srebrenica, the people being executed in Srebrenica.
I agree.
They didn't have authority to open fire.
I agree. I think we've done it. I think the Europeans have done it. And I very, very much supported, by the way, our actions in Kosovo to help stop that genocide. But I think that there's a difference between standing by while evil occurs, which is a bad thing, and actually going in and invading a country that never attacked us. And that's the thing that I think America is mostly attacked for.
The Iraq situation was also unique in a legal standpoint because it was a violation of the ceasefire agreement. We had been at war under international authority in 1991 with Iraq. When that war ended, it ended based on a ceasefire, an armistice, if you will, that was violated repeatedly throughout the time period. So we actually also had a legal authority as well as troops in theater, and I would argue a national interest involved. So it was
the legal authority was under United Nations resolutions.
And
yet the same United Nations refused to authorize us to go to war with Iraq.
And refused to authorize the action, but they had new action, but they had authorized the initial action.
No, they had authorized, they had stated that Iraq has to allow the inspectors in or there'd be serious consequences.
Well, then that's the international community, and that's what they're going to do with, more than they do with Darfur.
No, but Colin Powell tried to go back and get authority for the war,
and
he didn't get it, because the point is that we didn't have the authority under international law.
Yes, we had the authority under the original UN resolution, the 1990 resolution.
Well, certainly the United Nations didn't think so. I personally don't think we should have to rely on the United Nations for legal authority, but I think we have to rely on some kind of authority. In other words, a country has to attack us before we respond, unless there's a genocide or something going on.
Well, actually, Iraq was shooting at American aircraft almost every day in the no-fly zone. And there was a $10,000 reward for the first guy who brought down an American aircraft.
Was it worth it? All the 4,000 plus American lives, tens of thousands wounded, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians dead, millions who've had to leave their homes.
You know what's interesting? When
Is
you say hundreds
it?
Of thousands dead, a friend of mine who was very much supporting the removal of the sanctions against Iraq before the second Gulf War went over to Iraq, met with Tariq Aziz. He kept saying the figure 250,000 people a year were dying in Iraq.
I don't think it was that high.
Well, of course not. And of course, what's interesting is now the same people are citing the same kind of numbers for how many people died in the war.
We only have a few seconds left, but I guess my point is this. We have only so much we can do in the world. Sometimes we need to respond not with a huge sledgehammer and invading a country, but with things like sanctions, because sometimes we don't have enough people under arms to invade every country on earth. Sometimes we have to use soft power,
and
not just hard power.
If liberals got a chance to pursue their foreign policy, we would be invading every country on earth. Because they love to use the military, they just don't want to fund it.
That is a very strange comment to make, but nonetheless, we'll have to end the show there. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Terry. If you want to comment on anything you heard today, please do so. Go to radioinsidescoop.com. Tell me what you think. The archive will be there. Check it out. This is Mark Levine.
It sure does.